Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Today we are definitely speaking hope and freedom to Iran. In the second half hour of my program, I have a very special guest, Danya Jam, an Iranian-American human rights activist. She's been on my program several times, and today we're going to be talking about her recent visit to Paris for the annual National Council of Resistance of Iran meeting and rally that they have there every year. It's a very incredible event, and I want you to hear her testimony about it. And we're also going to talk about some of the issues related to Iran. In this first half an hour, I'm going to take us into North Korea today. You know, of course, North Korea, Russia, and Iran are all pivotal in the news these days. You hear about the claim of Kim Jong-un, who's going to fire nuclear missiles at the United States. That is his threat. And, of course, the ongoing human rights catastrophes in Iran, and Iran wanting to, of course, continue their nuclear program, even though they claim they're abiding by the principles. We know what's really going on behind the scenes that is not being reported. At any rate, these two nations, Korea and North Korea and Iran, are pivotal in the news these days. Today, before I talk about Iran, I want to take you into the lives of Christians under persecution in North Korea. And I had a particular article I found from Willie Schubach, and it is a very good piece really explaining what the lives for Christians are like in North Korea. And I'm going to read this to you to give you an understanding of just what life is like there, and then we're going to play some sound bites, and I'm going to share the stories of North Korean Christians and their dedication to Jesus in spite of the oppression there. Many people in North Korea are declaring Christ as their Lord and Savior, as the persecution against Christians is getting so bad that the North Korean government is punishing people just for reading the Bible. A Christian woman who fled North Korea has shared how, As a child, she was too scared to even touch a Bible, but revealed Christianity is growing in the country despite the government's brutal efforts to suppress it. Growing up in the totalitarian communist state where Christianity is a crime, Kim Sang-hwa had no idea her parents were Christians. Quote, "Like so many Christian families, our family was banished in the 1950s to a remote village," she told persecution watchdog Open Doors USA. "They continue to hide their face from the outside world, but I remember waking up one night when I was six. Our house was very small, so we all slept in the same room. When I opened my eyes, I saw my father and mother under the blanket, and I could hear the soft noise of the radio. Later I learned they were listening to a broadcast from a Christian radio station. One day, she found a Bible hidden deep in a closet. Terrified, Kim considered turning her parents into the authorities. In the country, Christians are frequently sentenced to labor camps simply for owning a Bible. I was afraid to touch the Bible, but I just couldn't leave it there," she recounted. "I closed my eyes, picked up the book, and put it back. I weighed my options. Should I tell my teacher? Should I visit the local security official? For 15 days, I couldn't think about anything else. I knew it was my duty to report this illegal book, but it was my family which was involved. And I also had all these questions. Who is this God? Or what?" Finally, she asked her father about the forbidden book. "He was very surprised and sat next to me," she said. "He asked me, 'Do you see those old trees?' I nodded. 'Who made those?' I said I didn't know, and he explained the story of creation to me, including how God had made Adam and Eve." After that, Kim's mother began teaching her how to memorize Bible verses and the Apostles' Creed. Her father explained the full gospel to her, and her grandfather taught her how to pray. "It is just talking to God, nothing more, nothing less," he'd tell her. "To me, all those stories and ideas were so interesting," she said. "I also read the Bible for myself, but I realized it was dangerous. My father always emphasized not to share anything with anyone else. Then he would start to pray in whispers, almost inaudible. 'Father, help the North Korean people to see your kingdom first.'" Sometimes Kim's father would meet people in a secret location where they would pray together and discuss the Bible. "When one of the visitors was dying, my father went to see him on his deathbed," she recalled. "He confessed, 'I know everything about you, your family, and your faith. I was a spy and ordered to watch you.' And," my father asked, "'You are a good man. I never told anyone you were a Christian. Tell me, how can I become a Christian too?' In the final moments of his life, this man repented and entered the kingdom of God. My father was able to lead him there," she said. After King got married, she and her husband worked to care for the homeless in North Korea, but life became increasingly more difficult. "Out of every three people, at least one of them was a spy," she said. "Because of our wealth, which was obtained through my father's profession and our relatives in China, we were labeled as followers of capitalism. Afraid for our family's safety, we left our two-year-old son with my parents and fled the country. Today, Kim lives in South Korea with her family, but she hopes to one day return to her home country and share the gospel. 'I wish I could go back to North Korea and share the gospel with the people there and have fellowship with the local believers,' she said. 'I love their faith. I'd be ready to die for the gospel. I think that if I didn't have a family here in South Korea, I would have returned already and helped the people in need.' Every day, Kim prays that one day, everyone in North Korea will seek first the kingdom of God. Sometimes she gets discouraged," she admitted. "I feel the same as many believers around the world, where it seems like nothing is changing in North Korea," she told Open Doors. "When I pray, I often ask God, 'What's the point? Why do you want me to keep on praying for North Korea?' But then God reminds me, 'You know North Korea better than anyone else. You know the people and their suffering. If you won't pray, who will? Rely on me. Believe in me.'" Open Doors has ranked North Korea as the most oppressive place in the world for Christians, number one on the World Watch List. It's estimated that between 30,000 and 70,000 Christians are held in Kolinsko, or political labor camps. This is a great article put out by WillieShubat.com talking about North Korea. I want you to hear the story of another Kim about secret worship for Christians in North Korea. Let's listen.
Her name is Kim Yoo-jin, age 31. She was born in Pyongyang, North Korea. Kim's testimony is rare considering the numbers on North Korea. The CIA estimates that some 24 million people live in the communist country, and the best guess is about 2%, or 480,000, are Christians. Just a handful of them have escaped from the brutal regime and live to tell their story. Kim Yoo-jin is one of them.
Growing up, I was told by the authorities that there was no God in this world. We were ordered instead to worship Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, the leaders of the country.
Freedom of religion is guaranteed under North Korea's constitution, but it's never encouraged. What was it like being a believer in North Korea?
We met every Saturday evening. My family gathered in the back room of our small apartment. We had to be very quiet. We whispered when we prayed, sang songs, or read the Bible. We often covered our heads to muffle the noise.
Growing up, she heard stories of how her city, Pyongyang, was once known as the Jerusalem of the East. In 1945, 13% of the population was Christian. The city was the center of Christianity on the Korean peninsula. Half a century later, Kim's faith made her a target.
My parents often asked me to stay outside the apartment on Saturdays to make sure no one was coming while the family prayed inside. We couldn't allow anyone to know what was going on.
Over time, the meetings grew to include a few friends and extended family.
We had one Bible in the house. My grandmother, who was a believer from the Japanese imperial times, had a Chinese Bible. She translated the Bible by hand into the Korean language on pieces of paper. That's how we read the Bible. We found strength in those pages.
But soon the authorities discovered that her father was a secret believer.
My father was a tailor in town, and the police suspected something was going on. We believed they planted listening devices in his shop and on his clothes.
In 1994, the authorities discovered that Miss Kim's father was operating an underground church in North Korea. So they raided the home, arrested him along with an uncle. Both men probably ended up in one of the six labor camps in North Korea.
Do you remember that day?
The day my father was arrested, I was at school, but I'll never forget that day. He hugged me before I left for school, and like every other day, he reminded me to be careful. Every morning at the breakfast table, he would tell us that one day the government will come and arrest us for being Christians. He warned us of the price we would someday pay for our faith. I remember him saying often that even if I face death, I will follow Jesus.
Some 200,000 prisoners are being held in political prison camps in North Korea. An estimated 30,000 of them are Christians. The regime is routinely cited for human rights violations. Won Jae-chun is a professor of law in South Korea.
They were treated as a criminals, and especially like a terrorist. And they are prosecuted based on national security crime of North Korea.
This video, obtained by CBN News, reportedly shows the execution of North Korean Christians.
Do you think that your father is alive today?
No. Everyone knows what happens when government agents arrest Christians in North Korea. They never make it out alive. I know my father is in heaven. And he's praying for North Korea and my family.
Kim's mother, grandmother, and siblings managed to escape that day to the mountains. In 2005, with the help of a Chinese pastor, she crossed the Tumen River and defected to China. Her family followed months later.
It was a difficult decision. I knew that if I got caught, I'd be arrested and sent to a prison camp. But my family defected because we were being persecuted in North Korea for our faith.
Today, she is married and has a baby boy.
I am very proud of what she did. Her family has gone through a lot over the years. She's a hero in my eyes.
Kim is quick to brush aside those compliments, instead giving honor to the man who laid down his life.
I grew up in a land where they said there was no God, but my father told me otherwise. He loved Christ, and for that, he died.
She has a dream to one day go back to Pyongyang and share about this love with the people of North Korea. Georgetown, CBN News, Seoul, South Korea.
Just a very inspiring story of a young lady whose family led her to Christ, who, in spite of the government's brutal persecution, took a stand for Jesus in one of the most oppressed countries in the world, ranked number one by Open Doors. Jesus said, "If anyone wants to follow me and be my disciple, you must daily take up the cross and then come follow me." It is a death sentence to follow Jesus in North Korea. And so our prayers, our thoughts, our petitioning, our speaking out should be for all believers all over the world, but particularly in the country of North Korea, where it is a death sentence to believe in God and especially follow Jesus. I want us to hear the story now, just recently, a college student who, because of persecution, because of the brutality, ended up becoming brain dead. You know the story of Otto Warmbier. I want you to hear a little bit about it here, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
A developing story tonight. An American college student freed by North Korea last week has died. Otto Warmbier was 22 years old. The family says the awful, torturous mistreatment their son received at the hands of the North Koreans ensured that no other outcome was possible. Warmbier was convicted of subversion and sentenced to 15 years in prison with hard labor after confessing a year and a half ago he tried to steal a propaganda banner. North Korea has not acknowledged whether or not he was tortured, but we do know thousands of people in the country who have been, simply for their faith. Joining us now is Vernon Brewer, president and CEO of World Help, a Christian humanitarian organization helping poor communities around the world. Vernon, terrible news.
It is, and our hearts and prayers go out to his parents during this very difficult time.
You have been there. You've been to North Korea. You know firsthand the kind of torture that happens there. Tell us about that.
In fact, Lauren, right now, today, there are 70,000 Christians, not just Christians, that are imprisoned in political labor camps. They're tortured, they're beaten, some with electric stun batons. Some of them are beaten until they, too, are in comas. Every day, 70,000 Christians are tortured in North Korea.
And why aren't we doing anything about this?
Well, you know...
You are, World Help is, but what about the UN? What about the United States?
You know, Otto's parents were promised for a year that something would be done, and nothing was done. And it's time for Christians to speak up and to say something. And it's no longer okay just to be shocked. It's time to get involved. And at World Help, we're working in North Korea to provide humanitarian aid. We call it Help for Today and Hope for Tomorrow. Humanitarian aid to meet their needs of food and clothing and medicine. And then spiritual needs with Hope for Tomorrow, to provide Bibles, and we've provided over 100,000 copies of the Bible for North Korean Christians just recently.
How do you do that if people are being tortured for their religion?
It's done very secretively, and they are not printed in the country. They're brought in, and Christians take a great risk by receiving one. They have to keep it hidden. They have to worship in private and in secret, but they're doing it every day.
It is a remarkable testament to them to continue their faith under such circumstances. What do you think needs to be done to stop the torture?
You know, our own partner there in North Korea was arrested. He was charged with espionage, and they kept him for 240 days. He was beaten regularly every day, tortured. I can't even explain the atrocities that he went through. And he was finally released. He was convicted of being a follower of Jesus Christ. And when they released him from prison, he was a broken man with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And he's just, his life is in pieces now because of the torture and the oppression.
As will the family of Otto Warmbier. They will never, ever get over this tragedy.
For 16 years in a row, North Korea has been ranked number one as oppressing Christians worldwide. They're the number one oppressor of Christians in the world, and we need to pray for the Christians in North Korea. World Help is trying to be the hands and feet of Jesus on the ground in North Korea.
Vernon Brewer, President and CEO of World Help, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you, Lauren.
Just an eye-opening account of what goes on behind the scenes and needs to be reported and brought to awareness every day. And that's what I'm doing today on The Cross in the Desert, to bring awareness for the severe persecution of Christians in North Korea. A very well-known individual who a couple of years ago was released from prison in North Korea was Kenneth Bay. As a Christian, he has an incredible story to tell, and we're going to hear his story right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
An American once held in North Korea is opening up this morning about his captivity. In 2014, Kenneth Bay came home after 2 years in a North Korean prison. He is detailing his time inside the secretive country in the new book, Not Forgotten. Only on CBS This Morning, he showed Margaret Brennan how he now views his imprisonment as a blessing. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning. Well, Kenneth Bay had made 18 trips to North Korea, and as a foreigner, each one was as dangerous as the one before. But in 2012, he was arrested and accused of trying to overthrow the government. He became the first American sentenced to hard labor and the longest held since the Korean War. He was left wondering if anyone was going to come save him. They called you Prisoner 103.
It's still stuck in my head, and I feel like I'm carrying this batch of 103 in my chest forever.
Before he was taken prisoner, Korean-born Kenneth Bay was a preacher and missionary. He grew up in a tight-knit family in California and went on to start a tourism business bringing Christian groups into North Korea. But he made a fateful mistake. In 2012, he brought in a computer hard drive loaded with prayers and pictures of starving North Korean children.
They said that you attempt to overthrow the government through prayer and worship. And they really took the prayer as a weapon against them.
Any criticism of the regime is forbidden. Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un and his family consider themselves gods. He was arrested, charged with espionage, and sentenced to 15 years hard labor.
One of the prosecutors told me that I was the worst, most dangerous American criminal they ever apprehended since the Korean War. And I say, why? And they said, because you brought, not only you came to do a mission work on your own, you asked others to join.
Bay's fate was now in the hands of a young and brutal dictator scorned by the U.S. for carrying out a series of underground nuclear tests. Tensions with the U.S. spiked.
So you were a political pawn, you believe?
I believe so.
You write about the trial. All of America really was on trial with me.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
I believe that they blame everything wrong with their country to America. They say the reason for poverty, reason for their suffering is all caused by U.S. foreign policy against them. And therefore, by indicting me, they were indicting the U.S.
Bay spent nearly 2 years under 24-hour watch by 30 North Korean guards. The conditions were dire. He shoveled coal and worked the fields. He lost 50 pounds and was briefly hospitalized.
I'm looking at a mirror in the bathroom every day and say, remember your missionary. This is why we are here for. I took it as a blessing rather than a curse or suffering.
You were in a labor camp.
Yes.
And you thought that was a blessing?
Well, it's very hard for me to even say that right now. But no one likes suffering. No one will embrace suffering. But when suffering comes to you, you have to face it.
Kim Jong-un finally issued a pardon in 2014. After the White House sent U.S. Intelligence Chief James Clapper to pick up Bay and another prisoner. Bay said he'd never been so proud to be American.
I was just overwhelmed that after being there for 735 days, I was finally going home.
Bay says he's not angry about his imprisonment. He believes it was an opportunity to share his faith and teach his guards what life is like outside of North Korea.
I was just there to love the people, let people know that God cares about them and the rest of the world cares about them. I hope that this book becomes a reminder to people to not forget the people of North Korea, have more compassion for the people who are living as a prisoner in their life.
Now, 21-year-old student Ada Warmbier is currently facing a similar 15-year hard labor sentence, and Kenneth told us he has reached out to his family, and he is advising them to speak out because Kenneth and his family believe that made a big difference in his case and in basically helping to secure his freedom.
It's amazing that he can go through what he went through and still come out and talk the way that he has, that he sees it as a blessing.
He said he left thinking of some of his guards as friends.
Yeah, yeah. I bet he showed them a lot.
First American they'd ever met.
Thank you, Margaret.
Kenneth Bay can say it was a blessing because to suffer for Christ, it is an opportunity and an honor to reach out to your persecutors with the gospel. And so I can understand fully why Kenneth Bay can say that. Nonetheless, it was horrible. It was brutal. But he counted it to suffer for Jesus and proclaim the gospel in chains. So God bless Kenneth Bay. And definitely read his book, Never Forgotten. I want you to hear a song today from Michael W. Smith before I interview Donya Jam. This is a song dedicated to all of the Christians in North Korea who unashamedly and fearlessly stand for Jesus Christ. Let's listen. Oop, we're going to get it going here. Of Michael W. Smith dedicated to North Korean suffering Christians. Right now, On the phone with me is my very special friend, Donya Jam. She is an Iranian-American human rights activist, and I want to welcome you this morning, Donya, to the Cross in the Desert. How are you doing?
Hi, Randy. It's so great to talk to you, and thank you for inviting me to your program. I'm very excited to for our discussion today.
Well, Donya, for the last half an hour, I've been talking about Christians in North Korea. And before we talk about your travels to Paris for the NCRI annual convention, I want to talk to you as an Iranian American about the Christian persecution in Iran. Now, you have some very important facts you need to share with our audience about how Christians are treated in Iran.
Sure, yes. So the Iranian regime, you know, ever since it came into power in 1979, it has been brutally cracking down on Christians. And many Christian leaders, Christian bishops, pastors have been brutally murdered by the Iranian regime, especially in 1994. And now that, you know, we're in a new, you know, world where we have social media and all the eyes are on the Iranian regime, so they can't as easily kill Christians. But they are still persecuting against them. And during this past month, many Christians have been imprisoned and given very long prison terms, including Pastor Yusuf Nadirkhani, who was previously even sentenced to death a few years ago. He was released, and now the Iranian regime has arrested him again and sentenced him to 10 years imprisonment for his Christian faith. Now, he's not the only one. There was about four, or I believe even more than that. But I know there was four more Iranian Christians that have been arrested, and they have also been given 10-year prison terms for their Christian faith. We also have a number of Christians who are on hunger strike in Iran, such as Ebrahim Firouzi. He announced on July 17th that he will be going on hunger strike for 10 days to protest against the persecution of Christians, against those newly Christian converts that have recently been arrested, and the situation of Christians, it's deteriorating. It's heightened in the past month, and Iran continues to persecute against Christians, and we definitely need more international attention. And thank you for bringing this to light on your radio program, Randy.
Yes, and one of the things that happens very frequently is that all of these Christian prisoners and those that go on hunger strikes are never given any medical attention, and they go through what's called silent execution, whereas if they are sentenced to death, let's say, they won't give them any medical attention, and they just end up dying from disease and famine and hunger. And so that needs to be pointed out, too, that the Iranian regime wants to paint this picture that they're a wonderful free country in the world, and it's a lie. And you got facts to back that up, Donya. For instance, under Rouhani, who is now president again, there has been more than 3,000 plus executions. That probably has soared to 3,500. Isn't that right?
Correct, Randy. During his first term, President Hassan Rouhani, under his watch, more than 3,000 inmates have been executed, and that includes many political prisoners, many youth, many women, and for his second term, not even a few days passed, and reports indicate that 10 inmates were executed during the first few days he was reelected. It's unbelievable, and the executions continue today. During the first 2 weeks of July, Randy, 57 inmates have been executed, and unfortunately, there is not international attention. The amount that needs to be given to the situation in Iran, it's not there. That's why the Iranian regime can execute so many. It's because everybody is silent, unfortunately, and this is why we must work and bring this situation, this critical situation, to light.
Another thing I wanted to point out about persecution was the Baha'i faith. Maybe not too many people know about them, but they are also under persecution for their faith. They're not allowed to attend university. And the Kurdish people, if you're Kurdish and you live in Iran, you are discriminated against and you're executed and treated like dogs. So the Iranian regime under Rouhani, there has been no reform, there has been no freedom, and they try to paint this picture to the world that the Iranian people have a democratic process in electing presidents, but we both of us know that's not true, that there's really no freedom not only in religion in Iran, but also in elections, and it's a big facade, and it's an image they try to portray to the world.
That is so correct, and, you know, a lot of So Christians and Baha'is and Kurds, people of all different ethnicities and religions and Sunnis, they are all persecuted against in Iran. And as you mentioned, Hassan Rouhani, he brought no moderation, no reform. Those were all lies. And actually, the Iranian resistance has said this from day one, that such a brutal regime will never be able to reform. And therefore, that is why we believe, I mean, the Iranian resistance and the Iranian people, they believe that the only solution would be regime change.
Exactly. There's no reform. Now, Donya, our government is stepping up the pressure on Iran by issuing more sanctions against North Korea, Russia, and Iran. And it sounds like the Trump administration is not going to just talk about the nuclear problem, but they're also going to respond to the human rights violations in Iran. And that's why they're stepping up these sanctions. I wanted to know, what are your thoughts on the process of sanctions? Does it really help the situation, or does it make life worse for the innocent Iranian people who are being oppressed?
That's a very interesting question. In my perspective, sanctions are definitely needed on the regime. This is because sanctions will weaken the Iranian regime and make whatever they're trying to do, you know, harder, which is what we need. And what I mean by that is, you know, the Iranian regime is the one hurting the Iranian people. They're the one who are executing and torturing Iranians. They're the ones who are exporting terrorism and fundamentalism in the Middle East region. And it is the Iranian regime that is hurting the Iranian people, not these sanctions. It's the regime. It's the regime's fault. There's millions under the poverty line. Why? Iran is a very resourceful country. It's very rich in oil and gas reserves. So why must millions and millions of our people in Iran be under the poverty line? It makes no sense. And therefore, it's the regime that is hurting the Iranian people, and sanctions weaken the Iranian regime, and it will help the Iranian people as they want regime change. The sanctions help the Iranian people and weaken the Iranian regime, which is what we need.
Exactly. Now, under the Obama administration, there was a ransom paid for the release of Saeed Abedini, Ammar Hekmati, and other Americans. The Obama administration basically gave billions of dollars to this regime, which the Iranian people never have seen a cent of. All of this ransom money and sanction relief money was given to terrorism. And that's what goes on here in Iran. This money is fueling Hezbollah throughout the world. It is fueling Iranian terrorism, isn't it?
Correct. Exactly. All this money, not a cent, goes to the Iranian people. If it did, we wouldn't have so many living in cardboard boxes. We wouldn't have so many people sleeping hungry at night. This money all goes to the suppression of the Iranian people. This money all goes to the continuation of prolonging the Syrian crisis. As you know, Iran, through its IRGC forces, has helped propping up the Assad regime. And to go back to what you said about the Trump administration and, you know, events going on in Congress, you know, the IRGC, one of the plans of a new resolution that has just been, introduced and, people are congressional members, they're all voting. They actually voted, but the Senate, we're waiting for their vote and the president's signature. But what this new resolution does, what it's going to target the IRGC. And actually, I have an excerpt here about the IRGC and their, the horrific things they are doing. It's only one sentence, two sentences, if I could go ahead and read that, Randy.
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Sure. It says, through its Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Iran is strengthening the terrorist group Hezbollah, like you mentioned, supporting Syria's murderous Assad regime, and fueling the civil war in Yemen. It also continues to unjustly imprison Americans and repress the Iranian people with terrible human rights abuses. So this new resolution that will be targeting the IRGC is very critical for us, because it'll weaken the Iranian regime, and this force, the IRGC, is very big for the Iranian regime and prolongs the regime. So if this terrorist entity, the IRGC, if they're targeted and weakened, this will highly benefit the Iranian people.
We are seeing, Donya, under President Trump, more fierce, aggressive tactics to stop this regime and to have them replaced. We are seeing an administration that is doing something for the Iranian people, unlike the Obama administration. All that the Obama administration did was to secure a legacy for Barack Obama, while Trump is doing something for the Iranian people. Are you really encouraged by this?
Correct. I'm always, so hesitant, because it seems that U.S. presidents have always continued this policy of appeasement, especially under the Obama administration, the concessions given to the regime and, the money given to the regime and the nuclear deal. Those were all really catastrophic for the Iranian people. And it's even emboldened Iran to continue its human rights abuses, to continue its help to the Assad regime. But the Trump administration has been taking a different course, and it's a more positive one so far. And I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful, especially if this new resolution is signed and becomes a law and weakens the IRGC. I will be very hopeful. Hopeful. Mm-hmm. And, I really hope that this administration takes a different route and fixes all its mistakes that past administrations have made in the past, and doesn't continue this road of appeasement with the Iranian regime, which has just created more havoc in the Middle East. So I really have hope in the Trump administration, and really hope that they continue to side with the Iranian people.
Amen. I agree with you, Donya. We have to be careful. Politicians somehow even disappoint us. Somehow they don't follow through with their promises. But I think you and I mm-hmm. both agree that with President Trump, I think we're going to see more progress to bringing democracy to Iran. Now, I want to talk to you about the activities you're involved in with the National Council of the Resistance of Iran. Every year there is an annual gathering in Paris, and I always get so excited because you talk about it, you post about it on your mm-hmm. Facebook page, you'll send pictures, and this year we had Facebook Live even showing some of the speakers. I want you to talk to us about the vision you have for a free Iran through the National Council of the Resistance of Iran, and then tell us about the happenings at Paris this year, what went on.
Sure. So as you mentioned, this is an annual gathering, and this year it was held on July 1st, 2017. And the goal of this gathering this year was show the international community that regime change is the solution for Iran. No to appeasement, no to war, regime change. And not only that, but the Iranian resistance wants to convey to the world that there is a democratic alternative. There's always been a problem when regimes are overthrown. The after part is very crucial. And, with this organized resistance, they're showing and conveying that there is an organized opposition that's ready to bring regime change and to ensure and guarantee freedom and democracy that the Iranian people very much deserve. And during this gathering, many prominent politicians, such as former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, Ambassador John Bolton, Newt Gingrich, they were all in attendance, and they delivered very, very inspiring speeches. And Judge Ted Poe, he also, I really liked his speech because he said that Iran's youth hold the key to freedom. And I was very lucky that I get to work with a lot of these youth. It was a teamwork effort, and You know, in Iran, unfortunately, youth, they do not have any hope for the future. They're, you know, they live in a very dark atmosphere. And what I mean by that is they constantly hear about executions and torture and what's happening in prisons. I mean, just imagine being an Iranian youth in Iran. You're surrounded by darkness and sadness. But when you, luckily, this program was broadcasted through the Iranian Resistance Channel, Simaya Azadi, by satellite. And when a youth in Iran sees such inspiring politicians delivering such inspiring messages and hopeful messages, and seeing youth and 100,000 people gathered to support them, you realize that you're not alone, and that there is hope, and that future, that hopeful and bright future, filled with happiness and democracy, is near. There's a democratic alternative, and that's what this gathering tries to do. It tries to send a message of hope to Iran's youth, to Iran's population, that they're not alone, and that future filled with democracy, justice, and human rights is very much near.
So the idea of freedom, the idea of hope and democracy, is much more than just a dream. It can become a reality. And that's mm-hmm. what the Iranian people have to know, that there are people like yourself and like me that care about them, that are crying out for them, that right. are speaking for them. If there is hope for this one day, what is the vision that you have and Maryam Rajavi has for Iran? Is it really possible that this can happen?
Of course, Randy. During, you know, history, history has always proven that those overthrowing oppressors, it's not easy. It's a very, very long and hard journey. And this resistance movement that is led by Ms. Maryam Rajavi has paid a very heavy price. 120,000 political prisoners have been executed by this regime. And these 120,000, they're PMLI members that have given their life for a free Iran. And 30,000 of those were executed in 1988. Many of those 30,000 were MEK members. And all they wanted was freedom for their country. And their path continued until freedom finally reaches Iran. Ms. Maryam Rajavi, she has a beautiful vision for the future of Iran, and it's laid out in her 10-point plan. And in it, she supports, you know, an end to executions, abolishment of the death penalty. She calls for free elections. She calls for the rule of justice. We want an Iran that is free of nuclear weapons. We do not want this. We want a country based on the principles of democracy, freedom, and justice. And because there is a democratic alternative, because this resistance exists, it shows that regime change is within reach.
Very important point that you talk about regime change, because on Facebook I have some Iranian friends that somehow have the opinion that reform is possible. And I always tell them that that is a lie. You cannot reform a terrorist entity. The key to the balance of power mm-hmm. in the Middle East is a free Iran. And both you and I mm-hmm. agree, along with Maryam Rajavi, that freedom for the Iranian people, no nukes, no death penalty, no discrimination, freedom of religion, free elections is the only hope for Iran, not a reformation. And you agree. And so this message, though, is such an important message for the youth of Iran. One of the things I always like about when we have this Paris gathering is the youth, the speeches of the youth and what they have to say. It's so inspiring because that's the key to freedom in Iran, the message of the youth, isn't it?
That's so correct, because they are indeed the future of Iran, the ones that will rebuild Iran. And, you know, as I've mentioned, just imagine being a youth in Iran. You're surrounded by darkness and you have no hope for the future. But when you see you're gathered 100,000 people and you see all the youth there to support you, you get a lot of energy, you get hope for the future, and it brings us closer to that Iran that we want to create. But indeed, the voice of the youth is very critical, because they are the ones who will be rebuilding Iran, and they are the future of Iran. So this is what I also really enjoy about this gathering, and I indeed agree that the speeches of the youth is always so inspiring, and it's always so lovely to see them and their presence in this gathering. And I love how the resistance, especially during this gathering, really highlighted the role of the youth. And politicians, in their speech, when they talk about the youth and them being the future of Iran, it's great. And it gives us hope. It gives the Iranian people hope, the youth of Iran hope. And I completely agree, Randy.
You know, one of the things I wanted to point out to our listeners is your family left Iran after the revolution and came here to freedom, and you're all American citizens, and you're speaking out for your people and using your freedom and energies for that. Is it encouraging to see your government so involved in this Paris gathering?
Yes, indeed. From my own personal perspective, when I see people like Rudy Giuliani, when I see people like Ted Poe, Linda Chavez, Newt Gingrich, John Bolton, when I see U.S. politicians, their presence there, it really gives me hope. And these are all people that have dedicated so much time and energy for America, for America's people. And it's amazing to see them also put in so much effort for the Iranian people. And it's because of these politicians and, of course, this gathering and people like you and people like the participants of this rally. It's effort, and it's because of these efforts, the efforts of the politicians, U.S. politicians, European politicians, that have all came together in this gathering. And it's because of them that we are reaching a free Iran, that we are much closer. So it's, of course, it's very hopeful. When I see them, it's amazing.
Now, this gathering is not just a happening once a year, Danya. This is just the beginning, because you're going to be very busy coming up in the fall. And tell us a little bit about what your activities are going to be in the next few months as you continue to work hard for a free Iran. What are you going to be involved in?
Sure. I always, try my best, whether on social media or attending protests organized by the NCRI, to help be a voice for the Iranian people. This wasn't correct. That just attending this gathering isn't it. There's going to be more protests to come, especially the one coming up in New York, which, Randy, you always report on. So thank you for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, unfortunately, Hassan Rouhani has been coming to New York during the past years, and even before him, Ahmadinejad, and so it goes on. And so Iranian Americans, they feel it is their responsibility to protest against such a terrorist, against Rouhani, who has executed 3,000 of our people. So we feel it is our responsibility to be in New York when he comes to protest against his presence and to raise awareness on what's happening in Iran. Hassan Rouhani shouldn't even be able to step on American soil.
Yes.
But unfortunately, he does. He comes here for the UN General Assembly. But we will always, carry out our duty, our responsibility as Iranian Americans. And, many Americans themselves attend, and it is their responsibility as well, because this regime isn't only a threat for the Iranian people, but it is a threat to peace and security of this world. So therefore, it's teamwork, people coming from all over the world to attend this protest against Hassan Rouhani.
Well, I want to just say to you, Danya, you inspire me. I'm so glad that you have taken your life and dedicated it to the freedom of Iranians. And like I've said many times in our interviews before, that you take your freedom as an American, you use it such a positive way to speak for your people. You are a voice for the Iranian people. And I want to thank you so much for everything you're doing on social media and for the protests and the Paris rally. You indeed are an inspiration, and we will see in our lifetime, I believe, Donya, a free Iran. I believe that's going to happen. I believe God will bless our efforts and our voices, and he will bring freedom to the Iranian people.
Thank you so much, Randy. You're so kind. And thank you for all of your efforts and covering these protests and always dedicating so much of your time and your energy to raising awareness on the plight of the Iranian people, especially Rehana Jabbari, who was executed in 2014. I believe also that a free Iran is very much in reach. Thank goodness for this resistance movement that has created a sense of hope for Iranians. And let's hope and pray that we are very much near to our goal, which is regime change in Iran, a free Iran with democracy and justice and human rights for all.
Yes, thank you so much, Donya Jam. You're always welcome on my program. Thank you for the hard work that you do, and God bless you, and thank you for being my guest today.
See you, dear Randy. Bye-bye.
That is my good friend, Donya Jam. I featured her life story in my book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. It's available on Amazon. Hers is an incredible story of her and her parents. This has been just a very emotional day, a very important day for me to think about my brothers and sisters and what they suffer through in Iran and in North Korea, and I want to speak for them, and I want to be a voice for them to let the world know that they love Jesus to the point of death. They're not afraid. They're not ashamed. And to speak the truth, they do it so courageously every day. So please remember our brothers and sisters in North Korea and in Iran. And I want to thank again Donya Jam for an incredible interview about the work that she is doing to make freedom possible for her Iranian friends all over the world. Nothing can separate us from the love of God. No persecution, nor famine, nor death itself. When you belong to Jesus, nothing can separate you from his incredible love. Today we have went behind the scenes to see what life is like in Iran and North Korea for Christians. And our responsibility as Christians is to be their voice, to be a voice of hope for them, to strengthen them with our prayers, and to donate and give when necessary for their physical relief. I want to thank Donya Jam once again, and God bless all of you for listening today. I will see you again on Monday on the Cross in the Desert.
The one.